Old Radio WIOO Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to talk with our friend, attorney Erwin Aronson, about the moral decline of the GOP or of the right-wing ideology. You look at all of these cuts, all of this slash, burn, and punish budget that they keep trying to ram down our throats. And you've got to start talking about terms. This is about morality. This is about family values. And why is it that the party of family values has chosen to go after your family and mine? The folks who are struggling to make ends meet right now. Because after all, they're no longer wealthy. They're no longer rich. They're job creators. Got some job creators. And the reality is the only sacred cows being taken on here is doing what the Republican ideology has been pushing for generations. Like I said, gutting Social Security, destroying Medicare, finishing off that right to organize, and pulling what few remaining teeth are in the mouths of our weak labor laws. And in the process, creating a permanent underclass, the permanent desperation class of cheap, disposable, exploitable workers. And that's the goal. And it's in everything they do. I look at John Boehner. How many people remember last fall when Leslie Stahl sat down with him for 60 minutes? He was the newly minted Speaker of the House. Remember the part where he told her that he rejected the word compromise? You know, he was asked about compromise, and he just shot back a couple of, you know, happy phrases like, oh, we need to work together. We need to find common ground, but not compromise. Because compromise means giving as well as taking. And all they want to do is take. Working together or finding common ground, those are easy. Easy to turn and say, well, they're not working with us, so there's no common ground. We can't work with them. Which is basically what this whole thing has been about. It's what we've seen from the beginning. Well, they're not willing to meet our preconceived notions. They're not willing to obey our line in the sand, so, hey, we can't work together. There's no common ground here. So it's easy to walk away from. Compromise is tough. Well, that's where the tough choices are. And it seems to me that all the tough choices are the ones the Democrats are having to swallow. Social Security, Medicare, the right to organize. And I go back to November of 2010. How many people thought this was going to be the way we go? Republicans told us it was about jobs. They were going to create jobs. Jobs, jobs, jobs. One, two, and three. Jobs, jobs, jobs. Yet not one bill, not one thing to create a job. In fact, everything they have done has been to gut, to slash, to burn, to punish, and to destroy jobs. So, you know, you look at what they say, this is what elections are about. Is this what you bought in for? In 2010? Because I hope people will remember this next November. Because the ideological extreme right is doing backflips. And you look at this this Independence Tea Party. They're just tickled pink. They're all tingly in the panties that the House voted on the cut, cap, and balance, or as I've been calling it, slash, burn, and punish. But you got all but five, you got five Democrats who joined with the Republicans to pass this through. And there were nine Republicans who said, this is a little crazy for me. We'd like to meet our obligations down the road. But here, these groups, ideologically narrow-minded, focused on what? On their line in the sand. And what I'm saying, at some point, the adults in the room have to stand up. And I think the president has been the adult in the room. And now he's come out and said, well, you know, maybe we can do a shorter-term deal, who knows. He's been the guy who's been bending over backwards. And to be honest, I've been beating up on him a little bit for it. The fact that Social Security is even something that we're talking about, to me, is a really bad position. The fact that we're even talking about gutting Medicare without talking about how do we raise revenue. Look, if things are dire and we were broke and we couldn't pay our bills and there was nothing left, I'd say, you know, you got to do what you got to do. But when we're still the wealthiest country in the world and we have enormous wealth, and you're saying the only way that we can balance our budget is on the backs of the elderly, on the backs of the disabled, and on the backs of future generations, I say no. That's not the right direction. That's not smart policy. That's not smart vision. That is extreme right-wing ideology. And I'm hoping that the folks are making those calls and writing those letters, because at the end of the day, what they come up with could harm us all. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. We're right back after this. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The nearly 44,000 workers at California's Kaiser Permanente may have another election to determine whether they want to be represented by the SEIU or by the National Union of Healthcare Workers. An NLRB administrative law judge is recommending throwing out last year's election results, finding that SEIU is guilty of misconduct with collusion with Kaiser that interfered with employees being able to make a free and reasoned choice in that election. John Borsos is vice president of NUHW.
What this is an administrative law judge who was asked by the region here in California to investigate objections that we filed about Kaiser and SEIU's misconduct, determined that our objections had merit and is tossing out the election.
SEIU says it's evaluating whether to appeal the National Labor Relations Board ruling. Borsos says SEIU should allow Kaiser workers another free choice between the two unions.
They should accept the will of the workers and allow them to vote unencumbered and accept the result.
Labor negotiations remain at a standstill since grocery companies and representatives for 62,000 Southern California workers began talks a few months ago. The workers have held rallies in Arcadia, Compton, and other California locations to call attention to the stalled talks. FSRN's Leilani Albano has the story.
Vons, Albertsons, and Ralph's employees have so far rejected a new contract deal that requires them to pay more into their health care system. They're also facing cuts in pay and benefits. All this is edging workers closer to a strike.
Something that I think that we should do if we don't get what we want.
That was Chris Schultz, a Ralph sales manager in Studio City. The rising tensions are reminiscent of the 2003 grocery strikes. Then, many Southern California customers sided with workers and stopped shopping at the three grocery stores as Vons workers went on a prolonged strike. At the same time, Ralph's and Albertson's employees got locked out of their jobs. Workers' advocates think they'd once again garner sympathy from the public. Contract talks have been a mixed bag. On the upside, Ralph's spokesperson, Kendra Doyle, says the companies agreed to pay 100% of the workers' pensions. On the downside, they remain deadlocked on employee contributions to health care.
The area that we're working on right now and seem to be the most contentious is the health care portion of the contract.
Unions, including the Teamsters, say they will not cross the picket line at striking stores.
This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing tall against a multinational corporate agenda. The Rick Smith Show.
All the things you want are real. You have you to complete, and there is no deal.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Our quote of the day comes from author David Corton in his piece, How to Liberate America from Wall Street. He writes, when financial power is highly concentrated, the ideal of a one-person, one-vote democracy is almost inevitably trumped by a $1, one-vote plutocracy. And it's hard to argue that when you see what's going on in Washington. And on Monday, we were in Pittsburgh for the Progressive Caucus's tour where they were going around the country saying, hey, now's the time to speak out for good jobs. And the hundreds of people we saw there, the stories we heard could have been anywhere in this country. People who need health care, people who need jobs, people who are struggling to make ends meet. And to me, this is a moral cause, helping families to make ends meet, and to thrive. So I've asked our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson, to come talk to us tonight. Erwin, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, it's always good to take time for this.
You know, I look at what's going on in Washington, and I see the slash, burn, and punish budgets that they keep throwing out at us, and I keep asking the question, when are we going to stand up and say we're not going to balance the budgets on the poor, the sick, and the elderly?
Well, the real question is, when are we going to act as a nation that is interested in people and in this fundamental moral issue of how we as a society working together in a community can do the things that need to be done to have our people survive? This is never, as Hubert Humphrey said, a question of how the haves can have more, but how the haves not can get enough. And we are caught up and allowed ourselves for far too long to debate these points on the questions of politics and economics instead of on the question of ethics and morals.
Well, here's the thing. We were in Pittsburgh on Monday night for the Progressive Caucus's Speak Out for Good Jobs Now tour. And there were probably 500 or 600 people there. And each one of them had a story, and it was an amazing event of people of diverse backgrounds coming together, yet I didn't see one TV camera. I didn't see many media people there, so the message didn't get out. In fact, I didn't see any stories the next day. So if, you know, you have these grand events where people are coming together, but nobody hears about it.
Well, you know, we got to remember that the traditional media sources are in the spotlight now, today. Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, a multi-billion dollar, multinational industry that exists not for the purpose of imparting information to help people make competent decisions about their lives and their future and their well-being, but to make money. And the people who make money in the media make money based upon how they can exploit us, not how they can transmit information to us.
Excellent.
And the sooner we recognize that in this country, our constitutional guarantee of freedom of the press is predicated first and foremost on how many commercials they can sell and to whom, the sooner we will understand that we can no longer rely on traditional media sources any more than we can rely on people who call themselves Democrats or Republicans. We need to begin to rely on the moral fabric that brought us here in the first place. This is a country that is composed of only the third or fourth generation of most of us whose ancestors fled oppressive governments to seek out a higher moral ground in a country based upon freedom, freedom of expression, freedom of religion, freedom of all of those things that we hold dear. And Rupert Murdoch has pretty well demonstrated that he didn't believe in that kind of fabric, even though he took the extraordinary step as a foreign national to become an American citizen. And we need to understand and act upon our interests, not because we are interested or committed to seeing how much each one of us can get at the expense of the others, but because we need to be reinforcing the idea that we work together as a community. And as a community, we seek out and pursue solutions that are those things that we can do better as a group than we can do individually for ourselves.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. You know, while I was in at this meeting in Pittsburgh, they had an elected official who stepped up to the mic and said, look, you know, I can't get the money from the federal government or the state to tear down some buildings in our neighborhood that would make it a better place. You heard people telling stories of how, you know, when the jobs were here, it was a safe, good community with solid schools and public services that did positive things. And now what you see is unsafe neighborhoods and services that are doing negative to the community. And again, these folks, and you got to give them credit, they came out, and I hope that they stand together and keep doing this into the future, because this is what has to happen. People have to get out in the streets, I think.
Well, I think that you're right. People have to get out in the streets, and they have to get out in their neighborhoods, and they have to talk with one another. We have insulated an entire generation from communicating directly with one another by moving to the suburbs and getting on the Internet. And we can't afford that luxury any longer. Our luxury needs to be bound up in the necessity of having communities that do for one another what we cannot accomplish individually. And that has to do with decent jobs. That has to do with access to health care. That has to do with the nature of the relationship between people and their government, because it is indeed their government. It's not somebody else's government. And we need to step up to the plate. There is an urgency here. This is not a story that is appropriately told about how things used to be when we had good jobs. This is a story that has to be told in the context of what happens and how do we treat one another when the good jobs are disappearing, when the economy and the basis for all that we live on and for has changed under our feet. What have we done to plan for the future? What have we done to lay the foundation for our children's future? What have we done to secure and maintain our rightful place in the world community? And those are not economic questions. Those are not political questions. Those are not the issues upon which political leaders of any political party should stand in order to secure a short-term political advantage for their personal futures, but how we all working together stand together to secure our own future, our own society, our own village, if you will.
I absolutely agree. And, you know, when I look at this this cut, cap, and balance budget that the Republicans right now are pushing along with a couple of Democrats, I go, well, what's moral about that? Because you look at this whole balance idea, you know, what you're talking about when communities go bad, it only gets worse when you're talking about these kind of stringent caps that they want to put on things and this kind of very narrowly defined budgeting that they want to ram down our throats.
Well, you know, when we were faced with an unprecedented attack at Pearl Harbor, Our first reaction had nothing whatsoever to do with a budget. It had to do with protecting why we exist and what exists here. And we are in very much the same war now. It is just that instead of guns and bombs, it is health care and jobs. And whether we lose our lives and lose our way because a foreign power has attacked us in an ordinance sense with military might, or we have been attacked in the context of a race to the bottom where our jobs and our ability to function as a country and our compass about making sure that children have an education, that seniors have access to health care, that people have a right to a roof over their heads and food on their tables, must be seen as a war. And we need to roll up our sleeves, and we have a right to count on our elected representatives to roll up their sleeves on our behalf and fight that war on our behalf. The money will come. The economics will be there. There is no doubt that if we had full employment, that the tax revenues of Pennsylvania and the tax revenues of every state, along with the tax revenues of the federal government and all of our municipalities that are in trouble, will come around.
Yep. Well, I mean, you make an interesting point, because what I've been saying is during this whole budget discussion, I've heard nothing about our trade policies. And, you know, I went back and did a little bit of research, and the last year we had a trade surplus with the rest of the world was 1975. We have been running massive budget trade deficits since 1975.
Well, and look at the history. What coincides with the period from 1975 till now? It's not that we quit being able to make things. We invent everything that everybody else makes.
Yep.
It's that we have chosen to pursue policies, particularly with respect to trade, that say we will open our gates and open our checkbooks along with our borders to people who do not have the same value system as we do, where they don't have labor standards like ours, where they don't have environmental standards like ours, and where they can exploit the world in which they live as long as we keep writing checks. And now we've reached the point where we can't afford to write the same checks, but we can't afford to write the same checks because we have ceded this other series of principles to people outside of ourselves.
Yep.
Perish the thought that we were the victim of yet another Pearl Harbor-type attack. What would we do? Where would we go to make the tanks? Where would we go to build the bombs? How would we be able to convert to a manufacturing and industrial economy when everything that we count on, from running our banking system to building our airports, is all done outside of the country and we import it?
Not to mention the brain drain that comes along with it and the lack of skill after generations of not being able to manufacture. That's what scares me. The fact that we, for a generation now, have moved away from actually doing things and tinkering around in the garages and doing those kind of things that we have been as a nation famous for.
Well, and we have done one other thing. One other thing that is really the most breathtaking piece of this of any of them. And that is that we have now reached the point where we say, okay, we will find it acceptable. We will find it appropriate in this state and in this country to not provide the quality educational foundation that our children need to keep their eye on that ball, to have the eye of the tiger on that issue. Because if we don't educate the next generation, if we don't provide the next generation with the foundation on which to invent the cure for cancer, to come up with the next mode of inner city transportation, to deal with the real and meaningful issues that a growing population requires, to recognize the methods by which we use our remaining land to raise food and crops in a fashion that will feed everybody, we will have ceded our position forever. There is historical precedent for this. Remember that the United States became a manufacturing giant in the late 19th and early 20th centuries at the expense of Western Europe. And Western Europe became that giant at the expense of the Chinese several hundred years ago when the Chinese were the first time the preeminent society on the planet. We are at risk. The risk is not about whether or not our budget is balanced. The risk is one of whether or not we will recognize the moral imperative of the issues of the day and invest today in those kinds of things. I didn't hear a whole lot of worry about the budget when we decided as a country to invade Iraq, when we decided as a country to invade Vietnam, when we decided as a country to invade and engage in a war in Afghanistan, or in any number of spots on the planet. We need to recognize that what's important to us first and foremost is to assure the health, safety, and well-being of the people of the United States of America and of the citizens of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And we don't do that by destroying access to education. We don't do that by allowing people's homes to be foreclosed upon. We don't do that by stripping funding from public housing. We don't do that by eliminating Medicare. We don't do that by crushing Social Security benefits. We don't do that by forgetting that these are issues of fundamental morality for any society. Period. Exclamation point.
And it's that that moral high ground that the ideological right has always tried to control and cede that high ground, and look where it's led us. Erwin, I appreciate the time. Always great talking to you and always great conversation. I appreciate it. Look forward to talking to you again next week.
Thank you, my brother. Take good care. Be well, be safe, have a grand week, and I'll get the opportunity, I hope, to see you next Wednesday.
All righty. Our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson. We're going to take a quick break. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this. Stick around.
To the Rick Smith Show.
Economists and politicians keep their fingers on the pulse of the Dow Jones average, feeling every tick in this narrow measure of Wall Street wealth. But the truer indicator of America's economic health is in the Doug Jones average. How are workaday folks like Doug and Doreen doing? After all, the experts tell us that we're now entering the third year of glorious economic recovery from the Great Recession. So surely the bluebirds of happiness are chirping again in Dougland. But listen. Silence. The same moneyed elites who caused America's disastrous economic crash are now doing great. Since the recession ended in June 2009, CEO pay is back in the stratosphere. Corporate profits have jumped up by nearly half. Corporations are sitting on a record $2 trillion in cash, and that perky Dow Jones average has soared by a delirious 90%, with nearly all of that gain being pocketed by the wealthiest 10% of Americans who own more than 80% of all stocks and bonds. The sounds you hear up there are cheers, delighted giggling, and the pop, pop, pop of champagne corks. Yet, more than half of Americans say the recession is still raging in their zip codes, and nearly a third of them describe it as a full-blown depression. What's bugging these party poopers? Reality. In this recovery, those at the top of corporate America are still practicing tinkle-down economics. They're refusing to hire the Dougs and Doreens while eliminating hundreds of thousands of other jobs, knocking down wages and benefits, and unleashing their lobbyists on Washington and state capitals to shred unemployment benefits, health care, education, job training, worker rights, and other basics that are necessary to sustain America's middle class. This is Jim Hightower saying, if a bluebird did show up in Doug and Doreen's yard these days, it would not be chirping, it'd be dinner.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith. Go on, take my-
that's what they're doing. You know, all of these handouts that we're giving to the investor class, all of these tax incentives, these loopholes, these handouts that we're giving to corporations, they're filling their pockets with it. They're sitting on a couple $1 trillion worth of wealth, and all we keep hearing from the ideological right is they're the job creators. They're the job creators. They're out there creating up jobs right now. We ship them overseas. And that's what they've been doing for a generation now. They're not job creators. They're job creators. They create up our jobs. They ship them over to exploitable areas, places like China, India, Pakistan, Indonesia, you name it, anywhere but here. And this idea that somehow we can incentivize, somehow we can give them the right tax break, or we can give them enough, or we can deregulate enough, or we can make our labor laws weak enough. Not going to happen. They're still going to leave. And what I find interesting, this whole situation really has benefited the investor class mightily. And I look at this, and we've talked about this in the past. I look at this this report that this guy, Michael Cymbalist, chief investment officer at J.P. Morgan Chase, you know, a good lefty, a good, you know, good socialist, the investment officer at J.P. Morgan Chase, in his piece, Eye on the Market, he said that the U.S. labor compensation is now at a 50-year low. 50-year low in both categories, both GDP and both in company sales. And that, and this is just amazing. Corporate profits for the S&P 500 are at their highest level since the mid-60s. Despite the fact that we have these high healthcare costs, besides the fact that they've got to comply with environmental standards, they've got to comply with our weak labor laws, that pesky minimum wage, you know, all those regulations, we need to get rid of all that red tape. They're at the highest level of profit since the mid-60s. And what is interesting is Cymbalist says, quote, reduction in wages and benefits explain the majority of the net improvement in the margins. And he calculates the decline in wages and benefits is responsible for 75%. 75% of the increases in major corporate profits. They're stealing from us. They're stealing from you. And every time you turn around, you hear stories of, oh, gee, you know, times are tough. We need to cut wages in defense of the market. We need to cut costs where we can. Wildly profitable companies saying, oh, we need more. We need more. Or you know what? We may just have to go overseas. And in his report, it's just amazing to me. In his report, he says that, you know, profits are up because, you know, wages and benefits are obviously down, but also because of innovation and offshoring. And this is the beautiful part. The Washington Post writes it. What's behind the drop in the share, of revenue going to wages? After all, the workforce of the S&P 500 companies contain more college-educated graduates today than they did in early decades. Our guy cites high unemployment and the addition of 2 billion Asians to the world labor force since the year 2000, since the year 1980. So now what they're saying is, well, gee, you know, we've got all these well-educated Asians. We can exploit them. And it drives down wages. These are the people who did what they thought was right, man. They went to school. They invested in themselves. They got a good education. They went and they were loyal to the company. And what happened? Well, what happened is they got kicked in the teeth. And I look at the Wall Street Journal story today about Lockheed Martin, the big defense contractor, laying off some 6,500 people. But they're saying, oh, well, you know, these are voluntary layoffs. You know, we're going to offer some, you know, some severance packages and early retirements. And, you know, we'll see who takes it. That's in addition to the 3,300 people they fired earlier this year. What I found interesting about the Journal story was, and they write, the company, which is based in Bethesda, Maryland, said Tuesday it will determine the need for further involuntary cuts after gauging the participation of the most recent plan. Involuntary cuts. That is such a nice, sterile way of saying you're fired. such a nice, clean way of saying, there's the door, don't let it hit you where the good Lord split you. And this is at a time when they are going to get a massive multi-billion dollar contract from NASA. I'm just amazed at this. And they're just, hey, let's get rid of 10,000 workers. It's going to help our bottom line. Another article says, well, they're offering these voluntary layoffs, you know, because, you know, they need to improve the bottom line. And, you know, it's going to be done tastefully. I saw a movie the other day with George Clooney. His job was to go around the country and fire people. And they're talking about how to do it nicely and, you know, how to be supportive and help them move on to the next portion of their lives. And I'm looking at this, 6,500 people. Say it, sugarcoat it any way you want. These people are fired. Their livelihoods are gone. Their ability to look their kids in the face going to be harmed. The fact that they may not be able to pay their mortgage. What's that say about us? Now, Lockheed Martin's a very, very profitable company. We give them billions of dollars. And what do we get? Here's your pink slip. We give them huge loopholes. I mean, you look at some of the stuff that they get. The CEO class. Loopholed to death. How many people remember the tax reform bill of 86? Where they told us, you know, we're going to close all these loopholes. And in return for closing all these loopholes, we're going to get those rich people to start paying those taxes. So we're going to drop the top marginal rate from 70% down to 50, down to 28%. And we'll just close the loopholes, and they'll have to pay that. They're going to pay the tax. But in return, got to get a pound of flesh from those working people. We're going to start taxing unemployment benefits. We're going to close the loopholes for you working stiffs to deduct that car interest or the credit card interest. And here we are, you know, 31 years later, all those corporate loopholes, all those investor class loopholes back, and you're still paying tax on unemployment. You still can't deduct the interest on our car loan. And we are saddled with massive amounts of debt, credit card debt, otherwise you can't deduct that. Yet, you know, the investor class, the day after the tax reform bill of 86 was passed, their lobbyists went back to work. And I look at this report from Reuters. According to the Institute for Policy Studies and United for a Fair Economy, they say that tax and accounting loopholes for the wealthy and corporations cost the government, and ultimately you and me, about $20 billion a year. You want to talk about a wealth transfer? You want to talk about redistribution of wealth? There you go. So while they're taking more and you're earning less, you and me, we're still paying the bill. We're still picking up the bill for the party. And we didn't even get a drink. And these groups point out, interesting little scam. It's something we've talked about on the program before, the stock option accounting double standard, which lets, you know, the corporation pay the executive in stock options, and then they deduct it from their actual expenses. It works kind of like this. They use the example of United Health Group's CEO, William McGuire, from a couple years ago, and the $9 million in stock options that it put on its financial statement, put it there, but didn't actually cost them anything. United Health Group claimed a tax deduction of $317 million to cover him. They're saying that practice alone of using this tax loophole costs you and me about $10 billion a year. $10 billion a year. So I ask you, when do we close their loopholes? Why is it that we seem to have this belief that if we just give the investor class all this money, we give the benevolent corporation all of the incentive, that somehow they're going to mysteriously and magically create jobs for us, when in reality, they're the ones who have destroyed this economy. They're the ones who have the resource to move jobs overseas, to jump from country to country in search of the most exploitable, most desperate labor. And they'll come back when you're desperate and when you're exploitable. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
One place I won't be, I'll be working. As long as my two hands are fit to use. Sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
My name is Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My cases are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job, they're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse. Because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children. Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. 2561.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. You can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I do answer all email personally. You know, you look at the last couple of days, the big story has been this this Republican from Florida, Congressman Alan West, who, you know, again, you know, just seems to me to be way out on the extreme. In fact, he's even the extreme of the extreme right-wing ideologically. Just way out there on a plank. Got himself in a little trouble because, you know, he evidently called Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz the most vile, unprofessional, and despicable member of the United States House because she said, you know, something about his about the cap, cut, and balance plan that West supported. And look, you know, she is right. It's hard to imagine that someone from South Florida, where most Medicare people live, I mean, they have the highest number of senior citizens in the country. Then Pennsylvania, number two. But the highest number of folks on Medicare. And yet here's a guy who wants to gut Medicare. And I think it's important for people to know that. And evidently she did too. So basically his advice was to shut the heck up and call her names. But the letter also got him into a little more trouble because, you know, he was supposed to come around and he claimed he apologized. His staff said he didn't. Just really a kind of a weird response from this guy. But what caught my attention, he wrote a piece over at the Red Country blog He said, quote, I believe we're headed toward the ultimate ideological clash in America. He said there is a widening chasm which has developed between those who believe in principled fiscal policies and those who desire the socialist bureaucratic nanny state. And I hear this kind of language, this kind of vitriol, this kind of divisiveness. And there's part of me that thinks, you know, there's a lot of these Southern Republicans who would love to take advantage of this divide in the country and, you know, have Civil War Part Two. Instead of it being, as they call it down south, the war of Northern aggression, they want to start a war of Southern aggression. And it's this, again, it's just kind of weird way that they've kind of put this stuff that confuses me and frightens me, to be honest with you. The fact that this guy feels so compelled to say, you know what? There's going to be an ultimate ideological clash in this country. It's kind of weird. And you see the story that right now, anger towards our government is at the highest point it's been in nearly 20 years. Results of the ABC Washington Post poll released today. People are angry with their government. 80% of respondents, 80% said they felt dissatisfied or even angry about the work the government's doing. So you hear these anti-government people out there pounding their chest and whipping people up into a frenzy. And wanting this argument, wanting this divisiveness, wanting this division. Because once we're divided, they can easily manipulate us. And you look at the fact the last time the temperature of the country was this high was during the 90s, 92 when H.W. Bush was president, during the recession years during his presidency. And it appears, I mean, the way you look at it, Republicans are the ones who keep stoking this fire. But there's part of me that says, you know what? They're going to get burned by it. They're going to get burned by their obstructionism. I mean, you look at the hostage situation they're holding us under with this debt. You look at the hostage situation that's coming down the road with the FAA, which we're going to talk about in the next segment. You look at this stuff and you go, these are people with no vision. These are people with no real plan for the country. All they want to do is tear down, tear apart. You know, I look at these folks as a carpenter who doesn't know how to hammer a nail. All he knows how to do is demolish a house. Does that really make him a carpenter? No. But that's all they know. They know how to tear things apart. They know how to destroy. They don't know how to build. You look at another poll from earlier this week. CBS released a poll. 21% of the people polled approve of the work Republicans are doing. 21%. At some point, there's part of me that hopes nobody, they never wake up and they continue down this path. But I don't think so. I look at this story, and again, you know, you go back to this division. The state of Alabama evidently has been taxing their citizens to pay for a Confederate soldier's home. Now, understand, it's been generations since there have been any Civil War soldiers. It's been at least a generation since they closed the soldier's home down. But instead of eliminating that tax, now remember, these are the people who are vehemently anti-tax. In fact, they want to cut programs for, you know, for children. They want to cut education. They want to cut health care. But boy, we can't talk about cutting the Confederate tax that evidently now goes to fund this Confederate Memorial Park where they raise several Confederate flags and they have a whole bunch of investments. And, you know, they got the whole Sisters of the South or whatever, the Sons of the Confederate Veterans and the United Daughters of the Confederacy all leading the charge to save this tax. I mean, I'm amazed by it. And it's the only place in the country where there's still a Civil War tax. And it goes to fund something that I think is pretty divisive. Now, you could say, oh, well, it's our heritage. There's a lot of our heritage that we are not funding. Why is this one so special? And where's the Republican Party who says, you know what? Maybe that should be funded by the Sons of the Confederate Veterans. Maybe it should be funded by the United Daughters of the Confederacy. Maybe, you know, they're leading the charge. Maybe they should be the one. after all. These are tough times. We need shared sacrifice. We need to pull together during tough times. Tighten our belts. Like we do at the kitchen table. But evidently here. The home for Helen Keller, evidently, is going to be losing a bunch of funding. But this tax, it stays. So I'm curious. What are your thoughts? Do they keep the tax? Is that something we should be happy about? Do you see the same divisions, the same divide? Are you concerned that we may split? Because you look at the ideological gulf in this country. The ideological right is, they're way out there. Even for Republicans, and insane, rational Republicans, have got to be looking at this party going, what happened? How did we fall off the rightward cliff? Because that's where they're at. Just like I would, I've got problems with the Democratic Party as well, but the Republicans have gone so far off the deep end. I wonder if there's any pulling them back. I wonder if the next election people wake up and realize people like Alan West are taking the party down the wrong path. Or if they just continue to go deeper and deeper into insanity. They go further and further off the deep end. I wonder. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Sean Larson, Legislative Director for the Communication Workers of America, CWA, right back after this. Stick around.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show. Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The nearly 44,000 workers at California's Kaiser Permanente may have another election to determine whether they want to be represented by the SEIU or by the National Union of Healthcare Workers. An NLRB administrative law judge is recommending throwing out last year's election results, finding that SEIU is guilty of misconduct with collusion with Kaiser that interfered with employees being able to make a free and reasoned choice in that election. John Borsos is vice president of NUHW.
What this is an administrative law judge who was asked by the region here in California to investigate objections that we filed about Kaiser and SEIU's misconduct, determined that our objections had merit and is tossing out the election.
SEIU says it's evaluating whether to appeal the National Labor Relations Board ruling. Borsos says SEIU should allow Kaiser workers another free choice between the two unions.
They should accept the will of the workers and allow them to vote unencumbered and accept the result.
Labor negotiations remain at a standstill since grocery companies and representatives for 62,000 Southern California workers began talks a few months ago. The workers have held rallies in Arcadia, Compton, and other California locations to call attention to the stalled talks. FSRN's Leilani Albano has the story.
Bonds, Albertsons, and Ralph's employees have so far rejected a new contract deal that requires them to pay more into their health care system. They're also facing cuts in pay and benefits. All this is edging workers closer to a strike.
Something that I think that we should do if we don't get what we want.
That was Chris Schultz, a Ralph's sales manager in Studio City. The rising tensions are reminiscent of the 2003 grocery strikes. Then, many Southern California customers sided with workers and stopped shopping at the three grocery stores as Vons workers went on a prolonged strike. At the same time, Ralph's and Albertson's employees got locked out of their jobs. Workers' advocates think they'd once again garner sympathy from the public. Contract talks have been a mixed bag. On the upside, Ralph's spokesperson, Kendra Doyle, says the companies agreed to pay 100% of the workers' pensions. On the downside, they remain deadlocked on employee contributions to health care.
The area that we're working on right now and seem to be the most contentious is the health care portion of the contract.
Unions, including the Teamsters, say they will not cross the picket line at striking stores.
This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
Well, here's a fork in that tooth. You're gonna choke on it too. You're gonna lose that smile. Because of the wild, I can see for miles.
All right, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Have to check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, we have another hostage situation in the making as the ideological extremists who now form the Republican Party of No flex their muscles. And like any self-centered narcissist, they could care less about who's harmed as long as they get theirs. And in this case, the ransom is denying airline and railroad workers the right to organize. And I, you know, here again, I think a good compromise here is to tell the Republicans we want the same setup on federal level, on the state level, that they keep pushing out for union elections. I think that would be a good place to start. I've asked Shane Larson, he's legislative director at the Communication Workers of America, CWA, to come talk to us about this situation. Shane, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks.
You know, walk me through this. The Republicans are it's been a couple years in the making, as I understand it, to get this this authorization bill through, right?
Yeah, no, we're talking about the FAA reauthorization bill, which is all about the airline industry and making sure that the airlines and the FAA keep doing what they do, flying people place to place. And the workers who are working in that industry, they don't want them to organize. They don't want them to join a union. And bottom line is they're willing to shut down, the Republicans in Congress are willing to shut down the entire system to prevent workers in the airline industry from organizing.
So willing to shut down the entire system for this one ideological position, this one line in the sand.
Yep. That's really what it's come down to. I mean, for years, this is how really bad it is that if you wanted to join a union, if you were a worker for an airline or for a railroad for that matter, and there's a union election, if you didn't cast your ballot because you were too busy or because in some cases we found people who had been dead who didn't return their ballots, you were counted as a vote against the union. If you didn't vote, you are counted as a vote against the union. And a year ago, the new National Mediations Board said, you know what, we're going to have every election that's conducted for union elections in the airline industry, just like every other election in the world is conducted, you have a choice, yes or no. And the side that sends in the most ballots wins.
Right.
And the Republicans in Congress today are fighting that to repeal it to a point where if you don't vote for whatever reason, because you may be dead or whatever reason, you're counted as a no vote against the union.
So do you think a good compromise would be to tell the Republicans, fine, we'll set up the same federal, state, county elections that anyone who, for any reason, you know, they just didn't want to vote that day, whatever, any vote that's not cast is a Democratic vote. What do you think they'd say?
Well, you know, that's been our point. And you know what their response has been? Well, that's different. To us, it's
how's it different
about any other election? Other than the fact that you the Republicans who are running the Congress now don't want the workers to have a voice on the job. That's what it's come down to.
And, you know, I look at this whole scenario, and to me, it comes down to really, I'm sure there are other companies involved, but it comes down to the big money that FedEx has been pouring into politicians for years to get themselves put under the Railway Act so that they can't be, they're basically unorganizable at this point because they've been able to exploit our broken labor law system by claiming that their workers are independent contractors and also being under the Railway Act. Again, to me, it's about the big money that they've been throwing into this system to hold us hostage.
No, that's really what it's all about. I mean, in the fact that there was, when they changed the rules a year ago, there was no one that raised a peep in objection except for Delta Airlines. And Delta is the most non-union. In fact, they're not only non-union, they're aggressively anti-union.
Right.
And I can go into, they're charging soldiers now $3,000-$4,000 to bring their luggage on the planes and everything else. But the fact is that because they're bankrolling all these Republican members of Congress, they're preventing these folks from having a voice on the job. And it's ridiculous that they want to count non-voters, people who, for whatever reason, decide they're not going to participate as a vote against the union.
And you got to wonder how many times that they've done things to keep people directly away from the ballot box at the time, so that would absolutely be a no vote. I mean, there's a lot of shenanigans that can go on here, which is why I think some of the rule proposals that the NLRB have come up with are smart. Very modest, but very smart as well. And I think updating this so that we have a uniform code across the country is a smart thing.
No, I mean, thank you. I mean, thank you for saying that. It's really a question of, should we not conduct every union elections like every other election in this country? You get a ballot, you say, yes, I want to join the union, no, I don't. And whoever votes, whichever side gets the most votes wins. In for years, it's the deck has been stacked against unions in that, the company loads up the eligible voter list with people who at Delta Airlines, we found somebody who died. And the Bush appointed NMB said, well, that person didn't vote. So they count as a no vote against the union.
They actually counted someone and knew this, and they actually counted it?
Yep. They were actually questioned at a congressional hearing. The Bush-appointed National Mediation Board was questioned about this. They said, here's a person who was dead on the voter list who didn't vote, and they were counted as a no vote. What do you have to say to that? And their response was, that's the rules. They were a no vote against the union.
And, I look at all of this, and I guess there's part of me that goes, this is in with how Republicans see elections. I mean, you look at the fact that they've done everything they can possibly to destroy our right to vote at the ballot box with these voter ID rules and all of these newfangled 21st century poll taxes that they want to put on. And is it any surprise that they would try and rig an election of things that they despise?
No. Exactly. You hit it right on the head. I mean, they are all about preventing or making it as difficult as possible for people to vote. Because at the end of the day, their people are going to vote because they're going to pump millions, if not, in the last election, $2 billion of corporate money in the election process to make sure that people don't vote. We had an election at CWA this week. For the T-Mobile employees, 15 techs. One of the guys who was organizing those folks was so upset at what the company was trying to force down their throats. he went out in the parking lot and threw up. And his children were crying because of the fact that they thought he was going to lose his job just because he wanted to vote yes or no for a union.
That's just amazing. And, you know, what I've been saying for the longest time, to be honest, unions are really the last defender against corporate greed. And corporations see right now that there's an opportunity. Labor's on the ropes. There's an opportunity to take them out. And, you know, these kind of battles we're going to see for the next couple of years, I think.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. I mean, why do you think that the number one opponent to the new election rules that President Obama instituted for union elections in the airline industry, same rules we all abide by, which is whichever side wins the most wins, is Delta Airlines. They are so opposed to their workers having a voice on the job, having a union, that they are pumping millions and millions of dollars into the Republican Party and into Republican politicians. And right now in Washington, right now, their number one champion, Eric Cantor, and John Micah from Florida are threatening to shut down the entire U.S. aviation system for a provision that would prevent the updating of election rules for workers in the airline industry that want to unionize.
That is just amazing. You know, I go back to our quote of the day from author David Corton. He said in his piece, How to Liberate America from Wall Street Rule, he said, when financial power is highly concentrated, the ideal of one person, one vote democracy is almost inevitably trumped by $1 one vote plutocracy. And, you know, I go back to this and I think of all the money, especially since Citizens United, that has been pumped into the body politic, that right now corporations control this country. All I keep hearing is we need to be more business friendly. And I keep asking, you mean like Colombia, where they throw unionists out of planes?
Yeah. Or they assassinate people. I mean, in Colombia, I just met 3 weeks ago a guy in Colombia who is a sugarcane worker, who every day he goes to work every day and with a machete and cuts sugarcane, and he wants to organize a union. He wants to get a good wage and benefits.
Brave man.
And not too long ago, he walked off the job to go home, and a van pulled up with two masked gunmen and tried to kill him. On the spot, he fought him off with his machete that, by the way, he had to pay for himself because the company doesn't provide any tools to work on the job. And he fought him back. I mean, this guy came up here to testify against the Colombia Free Trade Agreement. And, you know, it broke my heart. I mean, this is a guy who I may never see again because he's going back to Colombia and he may go home tomorrow and be assassinated on the street, all for the reason that he just wants to join, he wants to form a union.
All because, here's the thing, and that's a little simplistic. What he really wants is a little bit more of the profit so he can support his family. And
right.
Corporations don't want that.
Yep, the same thing workers in this country at Delta Airlines are trying to do.
So let me ask you, last question I've got for you. This hostage situation that the extreme right is pushing, what's going to happen if this continues down the road? What will people see? How will this affect safety? How will this affect travel? What are your predictions?
Well, I mean, the Republicans are so insistent that they want to get this union-busting provision passed, is that they're willing to shut down the entire U.S. aviation transportation system. So that, you know what, at the end of the day, the air traffic controllers are still going to be there on the job, because those guys, those good union women and men who work in those towers are required to be there. But if there's an aircraft pulled off the system because it's got a crack in the frame or in the engine or whatever, there's not going to be an FAA inspector to inspect that plane and make sure it's safe to fly.
No, I feel safe already.
Yep.
And what
happened?
The
Republicans are willing to shut that down to force through a union-busting provision.
And the president has said if it passes, he's going to veto it, as I understand.
Yep. The president has been firm. He's reaffirmed that again today, that he will shut it down if the workers in the airline industry don't have the same fundamental democratic rights to vote yes or no like anyone else. He's gonna veto it. The Republicans are being obstinate crazies.
Yeah. When's the drop dead day on this? We know that the Republicans want to take us right up to the August 2nd drop dead day for the debt ceiling, and basically wanting to collapse our economy. When's the drop dead day on this?
Friday.
Wow.
Friday. This is one thing that no one's paying any attention to.
Well, we are. And
so
people
who have a flight on Saturday may find their flights not there.
Well, we're going to keep following this, and we're going to keep on top of it till the end of the week and see where this takes us and beyond. Shane Larson, I appreciate the time. Would love to have you back again as this develops.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks a lot. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. What do you think? Would you feel safe flying on a plane that may not have been inspected? Back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Economists and politicians keep their fingers on the pulse of the Dow Jones average, feeling every tick in this narrow measure of Wall Street wealth. But the truer indicator of America's economic health is in the Doug Jones average. How are workaday folks like Doug and Doreen doing? After all, the experts tell us that we're now entering the third year of glorious economic recovery from the Great Recession. So surely the bluebirds of happiness are chirping again in Dougland. But listen, silence. The same moneyed elites who caused America's disastrous economic crash are now doing great. Since the recession ended in June 2009, CEO pay is back in the stratosphere. Corporate profits have jumped up by nearly half. Corporations are sitting on a record $2 trillion in cash, and that perky Dow Jones average has soared by a delirious 90%, with nearly all of that gain being pocketed by the wealthiest 10% of Americans who own more than 80% of all stocks and bonds. The sounds you hear up there are cheers, delighted giggling, and the pop, pop, pop of champagne corks. Yet, more than half of Americans say the recession is still raging in their zip codes, and nearly a third of them describe it as a full-blown depression. What's bugging these party poopers? Reality. In this recovery, those at the top of corporate America are still practicing tinkle-down economics. They're refusing to hire the Dougs and Doreens while eliminating hundreds of thousands of other jobs, knocking down wages and benefits, and unleashing their lobbyists on Washington and state capitals to shred unemployment benefits, health care, education, job training, worker rights, and other basics that are necessary to sustain America's middle class. This is Jim Hightower saying, if a bluebird did show up in Doug and Doreen's yard these days, it would not be chirping. It'd be dinner.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
What the hell we fighting for?
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. During a previously unreleased interview with David Brody, Sarah Palin said that, quote, I want the mainstream media, and I've said this for a couple years now, I want to help them. I have a journalism degree. That is what I studied. I understand that this is the cornerstone of our democracy is a free press, sound journalism. I want to help them build back their reputation. And you got to love how she spins that off on the reporters. It's the reporter's fault. You know, it's not the editors. It's not the owners. It's the reporters. The lowest guy on the rung. The lowest, you know, notch on the pole. You got to love that. But it's with their ideology. Blame it on someone who can't defend themselves. Blame the ones who are unable to fight back. Kick the disabled. Kick the people who are down. Don't bother going after the likes of Rupert Murdoch, who, I got to give David Borowitz credit, he went after in his latest Borowitz report, speaking before a British parliament. He, Borowitz writes, media titan Rupert and James Murdoch vowed to launch a complete and full investigation to determine who's running the company they're in charge of. Rupert said, someone has been running News Corp, and as God is my witness, I am going to find out who. He said, I will use SEAL Team 6 if need be. He went on to say, right now we're trying to figure out who's running the company by process of elimination. So far, the only two people we've eliminated are my son James and myself. Murdoch's son, James, seemed equally in the dark about the basic matters of business, including his own place of birth, as well as his first and last name. At one point, a member of parliament asked James to identify his father sitting to his left, and the younger Murdoch said, I've never seen this elderly gentleman in my life. There was a poignant moment in the proceedings when the senior Murdoch described the emotional toll the News Corp scandal has taken on him. He said, quote, people have been saying such terrible things about me, so much so that I've stopped listening in on their conversations. He said, one point toward the end of the hearing, Borowitz writes, an unidentified man lunged towards Rupert, causing Mr. Murdoch to exclaim, police, catch that man. He may be the one who's running News Corp. And yesterday's inquiry was historic, because it marked the first time that British politicians have spoken to Rupert Murdoch while not aboard his yacht. And if he comes and speaks before Congress, I'm sure that will be the same thing as well. I have no loss, no love loss for this guy. He has been the evil incarnate in our media structure. But to be honest, all of the corporate titans, the handful who own our media, the handful that have consolidated our message into nice, easily packaged 7-second or 5-second sound bites. These folks who've turned news into infotainment, who've turned news into propaganda. I have no problem doing away with them. I have no problem breaking up this big conglomerate. Might be good for our democracy. And look at the fact that Roseanne Barr, you may remember, did the Roseanne show back in the 90s. She told this Chelsea Handler during her show that News Corp had actually tapped her phones. And she said, quote, I'm so happy to see Rupert Murdoch's stuff crumbling down because when he came to our country, I was one of his first targets, she said. He tapped my phones and people went through my garbage and all that kind of stuff that drives you kind of crazy. She says, and now here I'm sitting and that guy's going down. Well, she said, you know, when I first got famous, kind of lost my mind, kind of like Charlie Sheen. But she says, I'm way saner now, and that's got a lot to do with medical marijuana. Good for her. But, you know, again, you know, you look at how the media has been consolidated down. And someone sent me a clip of the Roseanne show basically saying, do you see any of this on television today? And I just want to play it because I think it's a great little minute of, a little minute and a half of audio of her meeting her congressman coming to her door and the conversation that happens.
Hi, I'm Mike Summers, your state representative. How you doing?
Great.
Good. I'm going door to door trying to get to know my constituents.
Oh, door to door, huh? That takes a lot of time. Why don't you just go down to the unemployment office and see everybody at once?
I hear you. And you're right. We can't let this area's workforce lay idle. That's why bringing in new business is my number one priority.
How?
Through tax incentives. See, we're going to make it cheaper for out-of-state businesses to set up shop right here in Lanford.
So they get a tax break?
Yeah, that's why they come here.
Well, who's going to pay the taxes that they ain't paying?
Well, you will, but you'll be working. Good, steady employment.
Union wages?
Well, now, part of the reason these companies are finding it so expensive to operate in other locations...
So they're going to dump the union so they can come here and hire us at scab wages, and then for that privilege, we get to pay their taxes.
Is your husband home?
And you know, do you hear this on TV today? Do you hear that kind of content? No, because they've controlled the media structure. You think this was something that was great back then? Working people understood. But we've kind of gotten this away from this mentality. We keep hearing we need more tax handouts, more incentives for business. She got it. We're going to pay the taxes for them, and they're going to come and pay us poor wages. And for that privilege, we're going to pay their bill. And it seems to me, from 1991 or 92, whenever that was, to now, they've really pushed that message, and we've bought it. We have bought it hook, line, and sinker. And to me, that's scary stuff. That they have been, in just a short number of years, they've been able to completely turn the message around because they own the media. They own the structure. They own the messaging devices. You know, we've been trying to find stations across this state. They're all ideologically right-wing. You don't deviate from the message. You don't deviate from what the right-wing agenda is, the pro-corporate agenda. And it's not even so much the social right-wing. It's the corporate right-wing. That's what sells. And no station. And that's why I give the stations that we're on here, WIO, WEEO, and the folks up north, WFTE, I give them the ultimate credit. Because they're willing to take the courageous step forward to be able to help get the message out. Even if they don't agree with it, and they don't have to. It's about democracy. It's about having the discussion. But we're quickly losing that, folks. We're quickly losing the opposition. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with David Matlin from the Center for American Progress. Stick around. Right back after this.
America. Rick Smith.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Instead of talking about how to safeguard the pensions of Americans who've retired or are about to retire, the Education Workforce Committee is going to conduct yet another witch hunt designed to prove somehow that the National Labor Relations Board is part of some vast Trotskyite conspiracy to kill jobs in the American workforce. The fact of the matter is, what's killing jobs in the American labor market is the inaction, inattention, and ineptitude of the Republican majority.
I got to tell you, there's one congressman I'd like to have representing me, Representative Andrews from New Jersey, and I think he's got it right. You look at the reality, and the right wing is just going absolutely ballistic over these modest changes that have been proposed by the National Labor Relations Board. And look, the right wing knows the NLRB has been the right hand of the right wing agenda for many years. And I look back to the Bush years and I remember a very pro-business NLRB. So now that the folks on the board are starting to enforce the rules as they were intended, the ideological right is enraged. So they're having testimony. And again, I think the whole purpose of this is to beat up on workers and to beat up on unions. Just more meat for the ideological right. Yesterday, our good friend David Matlin, director of the American Worker Project at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, he testified on the proposed rule changes. He's also got a piece, No More Lucy Pulling the Football Away. We've got a link at our site at thericksmithshow.com. You can click on David's name. It'll take you right there. David, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks very much for having me, Rick. Always a pleasure.
You know, you had the opportunity to testify yesterday. Tell me a little bit about what went on.
Well, so the National Labor Relations Board has proposed some rule changes to the way union elections take place. And at the heart, the rules are designed to ensure that when workers petition for an election, they actually get an election, and that that election occurs in a timely and consistent manner. Basic common sense and really small, modest reform that is good for democracy, and unfortunately, it's triggered this outpouring of opposition from the right, as you were describing.
Well, I mean, any change to the current system, which honestly and truthfully, the ideological right has a stranglehold over, any change to that chokehold, they're gonna fight back because they're in control.
Yes, well, the current system benefits the ideological right, and it benefits unfairly employers. The point of an election is to have a fair choice whether or not you want to join a union.
Correct.
And in order to do that, you need to have some basic things, including ensuring you're actually going to get an election, ensuring that, so right now the process allows for unlimited delays because an employer or potentially a union could ask for a hearing on any subject whatsoever, and that hearing, even though the issue is unimportant or could be dealt with later, forces delay upon delay upon delay. So the proposed rule would put those issues either forced to be dealt with right up front, right away, or dealt with after the election happens. That's, you know, part of, you know, you said at the beginning my column about Lucy and Charlie Brown, you know, so right now, union elections basically resemble Lucy pulling the football away from Charlie Brown's foot just as it begins to kick. Scheduled elections are frequently delayed or canceled, and workers are left flat on their backs. The rule change really is going to let Charlie Brown kick the football.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that they've been saying, a lot of the business people have been saying, you know, everything's just fine the way it is. You know, most of the elections, in fact, they use NLRB numbers, happen within 38 days. You know, why do we need to change it? If it's working so well, why do we need to change it? And to some, you know, when they see that half of all elections happen within 38 days, they go, well, it's working.
Yes. Well, of course, they're not talking about the other half. Some elections are delayed for years. Some, a third of all times that workers petition for an election, the election never even happens. So, yeah, a lot of elections work well, which indicates that if the rules operated properly, more elections could happen the right way. So some elections already occur the right way. That is good sign. That means these rules will work. That means that there is no reason that elections couldn't occur much more quickly. But the real, you know, as you were getting at, the problem is that some, and there's some dispute about how many, but really take far, far, far too long.
Well, I remember the Smithfield campaign was, I think, 17, 18 years in the making. There was the J.P. Stevens one, 25 years in the process. People could have retired in the time it took to get their rights.
That's, yes. They never get them. That's the fundamental problem. You know, there's been those of us who, you know, follow these campaigns can, you know, name a few, but there's also been a couple really good academic studies that have sort of just documented just how systematic these delays are. So, you know, Kate Bronfenbrenner, a lecturer at Cornell, and Dorian Warren, a political scientist at Columbia, found that they studied about 5 years worth of union elections, and the key things that they found, they found these endless delays, you know, about 3% occurring after 151 days. So, you know, year and a half, you're waiting for a big, for a chunk of these, but also that you've got nearly one in seven taking over 51 days. So a really pretty good percentage are really delayed. And one of the key things they found is that half of the violations of labor law. So this is when employers cross the line in their campaigns and actually break the law by, for example, firing a worker. Half of the time that employers do that, they do it before petitions are even filed. And that is just a very strong indication that employers are already communicating about elections well before, about unions well before elections ever happen.
Well, that's an interesting point.
The employer line that they don't have time to talk to their workers.
Right. I mean, that's an interesting point, given that's all I've been hearing. Well, I need longer time to communicate. And I would make the argument that you had from day one. I mean, the moment you hire someone, you sit them down, and every one of these big box retailers and most of the really anti-union employers, they sit you down, make you watch a video. I mean, they've got from day one. And then beyond that, they've got from day one to treat you well so that you'd never ask to have a union.
You're exactly right. The union communication is a part of a lot of employers' new hire orientation materials. So there's how you treat people, whether or not they'd want to join a union. And then there's this, you know, the evidence from actual legal violations that are occurring well before elections ever are even trying to be set up. So that we know that employers are already communicating well in advance, which indicates just how flimsy the opposition is. The line that I don't know if you've heard some of the employer complaints. They are protecting the workers' privacy because this rule includes several things that would streamline and modernize the process. It's not just about the timing, but it allows, for example, like electronic filing. Things like that that really are just part of the modern process. You know, we do business on email, et cetera. And the employers have strong concerns that somehow that, you know, electronic filing will take away workers' rights. You know, another sort of silly claim.
Well, you know, what I loved one guy was saying that he couldn't possibly get together all of the employees that he had, you know, their names and their information in 2 days. It was just completely impossible for him to compile that information. That it would just be such a hardship. And that's what I thought. Well, we must not be paying him, which is probably why they're seeking a union.
Exactly. Yeah. So you obviously were watching some of, you know, I was there. There was 2 days of hearings. Over 50 people were testifying, and the claims were pretty ridiculous in the opposition. You know that you know, putting together a list of your workers an undue hardship, which is what the law already requires, and the new rules would also ask for email addresses, workplace email addresses. There are already have addresses and phone numbers, et cetera. So
no, we couldn't possibly have that on record. Did you? And you know, what kind of business would have that kind of information?
I don't know. Only a functioning one.
So I guess the question then becomes, in looking at these rule changes and looking at how union elections are structured and how workers, you know, as it's appearing, are not getting their rights, what if we had this kind of a system, this kind of a hodgepodge, delayed system for our state and local and federal elections? What would that look like?
You know, part of what makes our democracy work is that we can count on voting, you know, for a president every 4 years for first Tuesday in November. We know that there's going to be an election. Just like you're saying, you know, if one political party could game the system and say, you know what, I'm going to throw up this roadblock so that it's going to be a week later, 2 weeks later, a month, 6 months later, when I know people won't be as upset about this particular issue, or whatever it is, we would think that's crazy. You know, there would be protests in the street. Yet what then that's basically what's been going on with union elections for decades, because as the, you know, employer campaigns have really heated up. So this rule change is just amazingly modest in its scope, and it's really about fairness and democracy. And it's sort of, I realize my job is following these issues. It's still surprising to me the amount of opposition that it's stirring up, given how modest it really is.
Well, because I think
it doesn't reform. There's, as you know, there's many other things that are broken with the union election process. The penalties, fire, you know, you illegally fire someone, and best they get reinstated years later.
Minus whatever wages that they earned during that time frame.
Yes. This rule doesn't change those penalties or anything. You know, it doesn't do anything else. It doesn't ensure you get a first contract. Doesn't. It's just going to actually make sure you get an election in a relatively standardized time frame.
And then when you win that election, like they did at Smithfield, 17 years down the road, 18 years down the road, maybe you get your first contract.
Maybe. Yeah, exactly. The rules don't even get to that. As I said, they're incredibly modest. They are important. They are significant. And they are a strong sign that the NLRB is finally taking its charge to ensure that workers have the free ability to join unions or to choose not to, and they're taking that charge seriously and taking important steps to ensure they have that right, but it's just a small step.
Right. Let me ask you this. You know, one of the things that I've been looking at this, I've been looking at the how the Republicans are doing things on the national level with our federal and state elections. I think they've been looking at the way union elections have been conducted over the years and want that for the federal level and want that for the state level. If you look at a lot of the voter ID bills, so they have the right to say who votes and who doesn't. I mean, it's kind of backwards.
Yeah, if you believe in democracy and believe that people's voice should be heard and that should matter in the way we govern, it is frightening if you're thinking of taking away people's rights to vote in union elections or their rights to vote in political elections with, you know, these, some, as you're talking about, ID rules that clearly prevent people who should be able to vote from voting. It's really a scary political strategy that's only narrowly benefits a political party at, you know, in the short term. I think we all lose when democracy is circumvented.
I absolutely agree. Last question I've got for you. You know, what happens if these rules, these proposed rules, don't pass now? What happens if they aren't enacted now? Because I understand one of the one woman on the board is going to be leaving at the end of the month. I guarantee no one's going to be able to replace that. The Republicans will block every nomination that comes up, and I understand there are no more recess appointments. The Republicans have said that they're going to stay in session until the end of this legislature. So what happens?
Well, it's a good way, you know, it's hard to predict the future, but I think what you're getting at is that this current board needs to act soon. Otherwise, it's unlikely there'll be another opportunity to make a rule change again for the foreseeable future. We don't really, you know, we never know 100%, but it certainly gets likely to get harder. So that's why it's so important that this board follow through. They've set up, you know, the board issued proposed rules a couple weeks ago. Then they held this hearing. Then they're going to have formal written comments. Then they're going to review the comments. Then they're going to issue, hopefully, a final rule. So there'll be a long process where public can comment and tweak things. So the board, and they are taking this very seriously. That's one of the things that really struck me in the 2 days of hearings, is even after 50-plus witnesses, the board members were still asking questions of witnesses, asking for, okay, well, if we tweak it this way or that way, what would happen, or does that get at your concern? They really want to get this right, and so I think they will. I feel like this is going to happen, and the board will do it right.
Let's hope so, because this is an important issue. David Madlin, I appreciate your time. Always great talking with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much for having me.
David Madlin, director of the American Worker Project at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Again, his piece, No More Lucy, Pulling the Football Away. You can find that on our site at thericksmithshow.com. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around.
Millions in this country don't have a dime to spare. Folks have millions in this country and not a dime to spare. there.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachman, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. So the big movie is out, The Undefeated, which evidently has been unattended. The big pro Palin film, actually the hero worship film, opened in 10 moderately sized cities across the country on Friday. The critics, even the conservative critics, two thumbs down. The New York Magazine, their guy David Edelstein said, I swear I gave Undefeated a chance. I did, because who wants to write, who wants to writhe in agony for 2 hours? He said he had hoped that director Stephen Bannon would show a side of Palin he'd never seen before. He said he thought it would be so cool if he could give the movie a rave, but it is a straight hagiographic, never mind, it was hero worship, I'm not even going to try, I can... basically saying, you know what? It's basically just hero worship. There were no opposing views, nothing. Time Magazine, their critic wrote, the director applies so much idolatry to the air. He airbrushes his portrait of the divine Sarah, so much so that the movie might be called Going Rogue. Adding, the movie may tempt even the most ardent conservatives to emulate their idol's tenure as governor and walk out halfway through the film. And that was one of my favorite ones, that they might, which from what I've been understanding, I've been reading some of the stories, people did after like 20 minutes got up and said, you know what, enough propaganda. Jeez. The guy from the Orlando Sentinel, Roger Moore, he gave it 1.5 stars out of 4, calling it an infomercial of almost comical omission. The reviewers over at Rotten Tomatoes sent 10 reviewers that gave it a collective 0. The Onion AV Club said it was difficult, if not impossible, to imagine anyone who isn't already a devout Palinite who would seek out or sit through The Undefeated. They gave it a D-. The LA Times reporter Robert Abdel, he said The Undefeated reminded him of a bad action movie. Hero-worshipping, crescendo-edited at dizzying pace, thunderously repetitive, and its own worst enemy as a 2-hour talking points briefing. The New York Times, the Washington Post didn't bother to review it. But, you know, what I find interesting, the conservative guy that they showed it to first, guy from the New York Post, he said it was excruciating. It was an excruciating combination of bombast and whining. And, yeah, I can see that. So I can't wait for, you know, the straight-to-DVD movie, probably straight to Netflix. They won't even print it on DVD. It probably it'll do that bad. But, you know, it's this kind of this media structure that we have that creates these images. And it's pretty remarkable. I don't know if she's going to get in the presidential race or not. She's got about $1.6 million in her pot. Unlike our friend Newt Gingrich, who is absolutely broke. And what I find amazing, our broke guy, turns out, likes living on the high side. He's being dubbed as the luxury candidate. You know, it's one of those things that when you look at somebody and go, well, you know, how would they would lead the country is how they lead their lives. You know, he talks about being frugal. He talks about being fiscally responsible. But here he is flying around private jets, spending, you know, almost $500,000 on private jet services, spends $800,000 on a website. You know, there's part of me that goes, the website thing, that's his next wife. You know, the kind of the John Edwards thing. You know, needed a way to get the mistress into the action, gave her a website gig. Keep her around, lots of activity. Part of me thinks that, but can't prove it, and I'm not saying it's happening. Part of me thinks that. But, you know, here again, this is the guy who's got, we found anywhere from $500,000 to $1.5 million in a credit line at Tiffany's. How would he lead the country? He says, you know what, we would, you know, you'd want to run like I run my business. I don't know about that. Some interesting numbers have come out, though. One of the things that caught my fancy when we're looking at the you know, the reporting, candidates have to say what they spent money on. And Mitt Romney actually spent $7.07 at Godfather's Pizza. That's Herman Cain's former company. So I thought that was kind of funny. Rudy Giuliani still has about $1.5 million in debt from his 2008 candidacy. So, again, if he decides to throw his hat in the ring, going to have to pay that $1.5 million back. And I go, you know, where is that? Who gets that money? Where's that money go to? Did he just screw his workers? Probably some. So interesting news. Again, you know, the whole, I love the private jet thing. I'm going broke, but I need a private jet. My campaign's going down in flames, but I'm gonna fly in style. And speaking of in style, they're talking about Texas Governor Rick Perry. You know, the thought is, and he's the guy I think, personally, I think he's going to be the one who gets the nomination. I think the party has gone that far to the ideological right that Romney's impossible to get past the primary. He's just not, I don't think he's going to get it. I think someone like Perry, who the radical right sees as one of the Tea Party guys, as one of the, you know, extreme like them, I think he gets out of the primaries. And there's part of me that thinks, you know, Obama wants Perry and Bachman because, you know, the center of the country is going to look at the two of them and go, oh, geez. But here's the problem with Perry. I think he's going to be able to raise big bucks because he's going to have the Bush team behind him. And there's a guy who's a builder there in Texas, one of his biggest supporters. Oddly enough, a guy named Bob Perry. No relations, but still named Perry. He's one of the guys who's given about $2.5 million in contributions to Texans for Perry. So there's some bucks there. He was one of Bush's big donors. He's someone who gives a boatload of money to Karl Rove's group. So there's going to be some bucks flowing into that campaign, which is why I think he's going to be the guy. And he scares me. You know, I made the joke not too long ago. What harm could a governor from Texas do? You look at the 8 years that Bush was there. You know, I think this guy could be worse because he thinks he's the divine. He thinks he's a prophet. He thinks he's on a whole nother plane. That worries me. But the money, that really scares me. He's the head of the Republican National Committee, the Governors Association. He's the guy who's at the top of that, so he's got some real big connections, and it's going to come down to bucks. Absolutely going to come down to bucks, and you know that whole divine thing. I'm really worried about that. This whole idea that you know he's appointed from above. This whole, I can see how the simplistic would buy into that and rally behind him. And I gotta tell you, he's the guy. Everyone keeps saying Christie could come out. Everyone says that Romney's the front runner. Keep an eye on Perry. Michelle Bachmann back in the news. She evidently thinks that we should be giving money that the government has agreed to pay to African American farmers who were screwed over by the Department of Agriculture to the folks who were harmed during the flood. Now, look, I'm not against helping flood victims. I think it's a matter of absolute. We have to do that. That's part of what our government does. But stealing from one to pay for another, robbing Peter to pay Paul, sorry, not going there. Well, that's where the Republicans want to take us. If you remember, Cantor was saying the same thing. Well, we need to have cuts. We need to cut, spending from somewhere else to pay for that over here. That's what the balanced budget thing is going to do if we allow them to ram that through. It means, can't spend above this. That means we're going to have to take lunch money from Little Susie, and we're going to have to pay for this over here. That means we're stuck to strict ideological guidelines, narrow-minded, narrow vision. And it stops us from being able to answer problems that may pop up. So it'll be interesting to see that. But, she's also got her name into something else. This week it came out, it turns out she has some kind of migraine problem maybe. And Polente jumped on the bandwagon again. You got to give Polente credit. He knows how to, throw a quick shot out there without actually standing up for it. I'm waiting for the next debate. I wonder if he'll not say anything about it then. But he said all of the candidates, I think, are going to have to be able to demonstrate that they can do all of the job all of the time. There's no real time off in that job. So he's the one, and there's wide speculation that he's the one who pushed the original story out there. He's the guy who told the Daily Caller, hey, go after this. She's got these problems. So there's part of me also that goes back to this idea, well, she's a woman. There's that time of month. Don't know if we can trust her. That's the right, folks. Back after this.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to Win. Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The nearly 44,000 workers at California's Kaiser Permanente may have another election to determine whether they want to be represented by the SEIU or by the National Union of Healthcare Workers. An NLRB administrative law judge is recommending throwing out last year's election results, finding that SEIU is guilty of misconduct with collusion with Kaiser that interfered with employees being able to make a free and reasoned choice in that election. John Borsos is vice president of NUHW.
What this is an administrative law judge who was asked by the region here in California to investigate objections that we filed about Kaiser and SEIU's misconduct, determined that our objections had merit and is tossing out the election.
SEIU says it's evaluating whether to appeal the National Labor Relations Board ruling. Borsos says SEIU should allow Kaiser workers another free choice between the two unions.
They should accept the will of the workers and allow them to vote unencumbered and accept the result.
Labor negotiations remain at a standstill since grocery companies and representatives for 62,000 Southern California workers began talks a few months ago. The workers have held rallies in Arcadia, Compton, and other California locations to call attention to the stalled talks. FSRN's Leilani Albano has the story.
Bonds, Albertsons, and Ralph's employees have so far rejected a new contract deal that requires them to pay more into their health care system. They're also facing cuts in pay and benefits. All this is edging workers closer to a strike.
It's something that I think that we should do if we don't get what we want.
That was Chris Schultz, a Ralph's sales manager in Studio City. The rising tensions are reminiscent of the 2003 grocery strikes. Then, many Southern California customers sided with workers and stopped shopping at the three grocery stores as Bonds workers went on a prolonged strike. At the same time, Ralph's and Albertson's employees got locked out of their jobs. Workers' advocates think they'd once again garner sympathy from the public. Contract talks have been a mixed bag. On the upside, Ralph's spokesperson, Kendra Doyle, says the companies agreed to pay 100% of the workers' pensions. On the downside, they remain deadlocked on employee contributions to health care.
The area that we're working on right now and seem to be the most contentious is the health care. portion of the contract.
Unions, including the Teamsters, say they will not cross the picket line at striking stores.
This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
But I know that somewhere down inside there's a feeling small and scared. And they need to know that someone out there cares. Have you heard the Republicans today? Have you tried to spread your love to those who love the NRA? Though they might be quite reluctant, cause they'll wonder if you're gay. You should hurt the Republicans today.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. I go back to something the priest said at the meeting there when we were in Pittsburgh. You know, he said that, you know, when money stops coming in the front door, love goes out the back door. You know, kind of saying that, you know, when times get tough, when you have stress, it kind of makes things tougher. Relationships fray. Things happen. And I'll take that to the next level, which same as communities. When you have a breakup of the community, when factories leave, when jobs go away, when families are struggling, when you have mass foreclosures, you have all the negative things. There's a lot of stress. And, you know, I look at this report by the Business Insider that is reporting that an unprecedented number of people have been diagnosed as psychotic in this country. In fact, they're saying 1 in 66 Americans are diagnosed as psychotic. And, you know, you look at the drug lists that are out there, and the list of the top 15 drugs out on the market just blow your mind. I mean, some of them, you know, like Lipitor is the big seller. They sell about $7.2 billion a day worth of that, because, you know, people want to prevent heart attack and stroke. And Nexium is the second one. They sell about almost $6.5 billion, you know, to treat acid reflux, so a couple heart diseases. Plavix, you know, over $6 billion to prevent blood clots. Another one, this Ativar, which is for, you know, asthma treatments. Abilify. Then you start getting into the Abilify, almost $5 billion to treat schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. You go down to the next one, this Seroquel. Almost $4.5 billion to treat schizophrenia and bipolar. And, you know, just amazing amounts of drugs that are being spent on these mental illnesses. Cymbalta was number three, over $3 billion to treat depression and anxiety disorders. And all of this money that we spend on drugs, you know, it takes me back to the One Sopranos episode that I saw years ago, where the psychiatrist in the show said, you know, with today's pharmacology, no one needs to be unhappy. And there's part of me that thinks, you know, we've taken that mentality to the extreme, that, you know, where even if we're a little bit sad, take a pill, pop some pills, that'll make you feel better. And I think there's a part of me that says we're creating a lot of these problems by pumping all of these drugs into people. You know, I look at this and I go, you know, the answers to our problems are economics. The answers to our problems are have families stop worrying about how they're going to provide health insurance. Help families put food on the table. Help families keep a roof over their head by having trade policies that encourage job growth here. Heal communities by encouraging factories to stay, by encouraging jobs to stay. You know, I look at in our area, that Carlisle Tire and Wheel. You know, some 300 and some jobs gone. What happened to those 300 people? What happened to those families? Couple of people I talked to, they're still unemployed. They don't know what they're going to do. The stress is tearing apart families and communities. And, you know, I go back to the thing in Pittsburgh. Those folks that I talked to, they got it. They understood, you know, look, you know, what's going on in our community, what's going on in this country is not a destruction of the moral fiber, is not a destruction of, you know, our belief in God. You know, God's not punishing us. It's policy. It's the fact that we've said we're going to open our borders and we're going to let every country dump their products here to keep their people employed while we say, well, at least we got cheap goods. But what happens if you don't have any more money? That's where the stress comes in. And then you go out and you use that little piece of plastic, and every month that bill comes, and there's a little charge, a little interest charge, and hey, you didn't pay it on time. A little more stress. And it's no wonder that we have one in 66 people who are psychotic. Part of me says that doesn't seem high enough. I run into enough people on a daily basis that I think it's probably one in every 10. So the question is, how do we reverse this? How do we pull back from the brink? I mean, you look at the discussions that are going on in Washington right now with the debt ceiling. I mean, there are a lot of people who are hypercharged about this. There are folks on the ideological right who have taken this idea that this is our stand. We're going to really do it now. They don't know what they're going to do, but this is the standpoint. This is where we make our stand. We don't know what the outcome is going to be. We don't know what the consequences are, but we're still making a stand. And we're going to show those liberals and that Obama. And they go, but you're going to bring down the global economy. Is that worth it? And for some people I've met, the answer is yes. Because it's all about making him a one-term president. Much like Mitch McConnell said, it's all about making him a one-term president. We're going to do whatever we have to do. Whether it's holding the country hostage for the debt ceiling, holding the country hostage over the reauthorization bill for the FAA, whatever they can do to obstruct, delay, destroy, slash, burn, punish. And the hope is, and I got to be honest, there's part of me that hopes that they go all the way and they show their hand and we suffer for a short period of time and you see the results of their actions and wake up and say never again. That ideology, this whole free market ideology, this idea that, you know, we can have open borders and, oh, you just come dump your stuff and, you know, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer and we can accumulate wealth and we can monopolize. All that's just great stuff in their mind. When are we going to see this ideology for what it is? Destructive. What's caused the working class of this country for generations massive pain and loss of wealth? The collapse in 2008 destroyed the wealth of the middle class, made that 401k that they rammed down our throats, 200.5s, took half of it. Most people I know are now just getting back to where they were in 2008. All of those years lost, gone. And where'd that wealth go? Well, the really wealthy did really well. And they also got your house back. And the idea is they're going to get more of your houses back. Because the next couple of years, like the Chamber of Commerce says, we want more foreclosures. Need to get to the bottom. Need to hit the rock bottom. And that means the wealthy taking those back. I mean, think of the scam that went on here. They got a bunch of people to buy houses, 4, 5, 6 years. They paid on those houses. The economy collapsed and the bank came, took them back. You know the great part about for the bank? You paid 5 or 6 years worth of interest. Because as anybody knows, on the mortgage, the first 5 or 6 years are all interest. You pay very little on the equity. Very little on the principal. So they got their money back, plus now they're taking your house. And they can sell it back to you so you can pay another 5 or 6 years, that's right, of interest. So I look at this report and I go back to it. You know, 1 in 66 diagnosed as schizophrenic. Not surprising to me. It's not surprising to me the amount of money we spend on drugs. Just amazing. But here's the thing. The insanity may be over in Metropolis, Illinois, and I'm happy to hear that. And I'm thrilled by the fact that maybe there's an agreement. The report is that Honeywell out in Metropolis, Illinois, and the Steelworkers Local 7-669 have reached a tentative agreement. In the coming days, when this story is shored up, when we've got an answer, if they have an agreement and if they're going to get back to work, we are going to get someone from some workers from the Honeywell plant out there in Metropolis, Illinois, the steelworkers who have stood together for more than a year to fight back this assault by Honeywell. And it's kind of interesting, the timing, but what I'll be happy to see, and I think those workers will be happy to see, is every one of those scabs who cross their picket line to steal their jobs when they go home. And at the end of it, they're always going to be scabs. And we need to go back to that mentality. You know, I look at it as a scab as, you know, just like somebody who, you know, if you and your wife were having trouble, you know, maybe got into a big argument, you're kind of on the outs a little bit, and some guy comes horning in on your wife, going, oh, you know, he's no good. You don't want anything with him anymore. You come out with me. That's the kind of person a scab is. And the best thing to do with them is pick them and throw them away. But I am happy to hear, and I hope this is the case, because this has been a long, long strike, over a year. And the conditions, look, you want your most qualified people doing the job. The community wants the most qualified people. At one point, we heard they had like 7 rail cars full of chlorine on the track outside the building. That, my friends, not safe for the community. And this is where the government really should have stepped in. And this whole case, you know, as we move down the road, this whole case should be something that the Department of Labor should be looking at. Should never have a situation like this. Never. You know, if we're going to be giving up a bunch of rights, we should be talking about how to get people back to work and not have scenarios like this. Again, another example of how our labor laws are broken. Anyway, gonna take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about privatization. I keep hearing the story, and I got friends who can't wait. They're all tickled that we may privatize the post office. And I guess Saturday delivery may be going by the wayside as well. But what are your thoughts? Do we privatize the post office, even though it is constitutionally mandated? Your calls after this.
Economists and politicians keep their fingers on the pulse of the Dow Jones average, feeling every tick in this narrow measure of Wall Street wealth. But the truer indicator of America's economic health is in the Doug Jones average. How are workaday folks like Doug and Doreen doing? After all, the experts tell us that we're now entering the third year of glorious economic recovery from the Great Recession. So surely the bluebirds of happiness are chirping again in Dougland. But listen. Silence. The same moneyed elites who caused America's disastrous economic crash are now doing great. Since the recession ended in June 2009, CEO pay is back in the stratosphere. Corporate profits have jumped up by nearly half. Corporations are sitting on a record $2 trillion in cash, and that perky Dow Jones average has soared by a delirious 90%, with nearly all of that gain being pocketed by the wealthiest 10% of Americans who own more than 80% of all stocks and bonds. The sounds you hear up there are cheers, delighted giggling, and the pop, pop, pop of champagne corks. Yet, more than half of Americans say the recession is still raging in their zip codes, and nearly a third of them describe it as a full-blown depression. What's bugging these party poopers? Reality. In this recovery, those at the top of corporate America are still practicing tinkle-down economics. They're refusing to hire the Dougs and Doreens while eliminating hundreds of thousands of other jobs, knocking down wages and benefits, and unleashing their lobbyists on Washington and state capitals to shred unemployment benefits, health care, education, job training, worker rights, and other basics that are necessary to sustain America's middle class. This is Jim Hightower saying, if a bluebird did show up in Doug and Doreen's yard these days, it would not be chirping. It'd be dinner. To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Now we all ought to feel just a little bit guilty when we look into the eyes of our kids. Cause brothers, it's a fact, if we take and don't put back, they'll have to pay for all we did. So let's leave some blue up above us. Let's leave some green on the ground. It's only as to follow.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So the story today is from the Postmaster General, a guy named Patrick Donahoe. He says that this year they're projecting to lose some $8.3 billion. As people move from paper sending, the bills in the mail. We see it all the time. Everything wants to go electronic. We want to do everything via email. There are still things that, go through the mail, but for the most part, what's going on is we're moving to an electronic system. And they're saying that as we start moving down this road, the mail delivery system is going to be under attack. Now, understand. One of the very few things that that the Constitution mandated. It is constitutionally mandated that a post office exists because they understood, we need to get things around. And this guy, the postmaster, saying, within 15 years we may be seeing 3-day a week delivery. We may only be seeing that happening 3 times a week. So Saturday delivery may be a thing of the past. Here very, very soon, because the volume isn't there, they claim. And I don't know about you, but I get a ton of mail. I don't know what he's talking about. I get bills out the wazoo. But here again, they're saying, problems. And for me, the problem is the right wing in this country has done everything they can do to kind of squeeze this down, take bits and pieces away from the post office, to feed off to FedEx or UPS and to privatize. And really the end game here is to destroy it and then privatize it. Because they see that there's money there. It's like anything that is ours, that is we the people's, it's privatized, privatized, privatized. And at this moment right now, I think it's like about 48 cents to send a letter across country. Which good luck finding that in the private market. I sent a letter to FedEx not too long ago. Because it had to be there overnight. It was like $15, if I remember. It was expensive. That's the model they want to take us to. Now look, the post office was given a monopoly for a reason. They needed the volume, and they have to deliver to everyone. I mean, the reality on this front is, the whole idea that rural areas and living here in central Pennsylvania, you better wake up, because you're the first ones to get cut. Because you don't have the volume. And the idea that we are going to privatize. If you live in a rural area, you think a private for-profit company is going to deliver to you? They will. It's going to cost you a pretty penny. You look at some of the places across the country, places like in Montana and Oregon, where it's impossible to get to. In fact, I was reading a story, and I forget where it was, but the only way you could get to this place was by plane. And they had to actually contract with someone to take this very small amount of mail out there, and it was mandated that they absolutely had to. They wanted to say, we're going to put the mail in a P.O. box nearby, and you have to come get it. The court said, no, you have to get it out to them. So they had to contract with a for-profit corporation to get it out there. And, as I look at this, this is the right-wing dream. They've got this on the ropes, and the reality is these are decent-paying jobs as well. And today, back in 1971, marks the first contract for the workers at the Postal Service. So you're looking at just 40 years ago, the first time those folks had rights on the job. But what frightens me about this And it should bother you as well. Once we privatize this, once it's destroyed, you and I are going to be digging in our pockets. You and I are going to be paying more for mail service. And it's something that we've taken for granted. And once it's gone, that's the end of it, folks. That is the end. And I don't hear anybody out there going, well, you know, it's a constitutional mandate. They have to do it. They have to do it at a price. And what's gone on over the last, you know, decade or so is we've moved it from a government function to a semi-private function where it has to operate on its own without government funding. And it was only a short period of time that that was the case. You know, probably from the, you know, the middle 80s where they moved it off of government funding onto its own 2 feet. And that's why you keep seeing the rates going up. And I worry about that on a number of items, Medicare being one of them. Once we take it off of being taxpayer-funded and turn it into a voucher system, where now you've got to go into the quote-unquote free market and purchase health insurance from the free market, what's it then cost? That's something we don't hear. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. There's an Indian company, the Tata Group, and I'm sure you've heard of Tata because of Tata Motors. They're the people who came out with the Nano car. $2,500, the Nano car. You know, tiny little car. It didn't really take off the way they thought it would, probably for the fact that it's not safe, and they've had some delays in production. It was one of these cars that they glued together. They didn't actually screw it or bolt it or weld it. Nope, it was all plastic, and they glued it all together. But for $2,500, what do you expect? But here again, hasn't sold well. But the company came out with this idea that we can get low-cost housing to people. In fact, we can get you this flat pack box, $700 to build your own house. And it's got a door, it's got a couple of windows, it's got a roof. It's about 215 square feet. A very small space, and it kind of, as when I was reading the story, it reminded me of a guy that you know, back when I was doing a show on a different station, wanted me to buy into these refugee homes, if you will, that you could actually carry with you. And it was about 200 square feet when you folded it out, and it was really ingenious. But I just didn't see a purpose for it. He wanted me to do it, to use one of them for the Hungry and Homeless for the Holidays gig we were doing. And it just, for some odd reason, it didn't work out because I was going to. But, you know, here again, you know, you look at this and someone's out there thinking of how do we get low-cost housing? $700. You got to wonder what that's all about. And I would love to see one of these houses. You know, but here again, what we're talking about is, you know, how do we get folks in this country housing? It's one of those things. $700. You could have a $700 house and a $2,500 Nano car. Oh boy. But you know, here's the thing. And you gotta give the Indians credit. They're thinking outside the box, or in this case, outside the Nano car or Nano house. But it comes down to production. Our quote of the day, another quote I got from off our Facebook page, comes from Eric, who says, when dead people vote for Democrats in Chicago, they cry, fraud. But when dead people vote against the union, they insist it's democracy. And, you know, you go back to that FAA reauthorization bill, and they're right on. They want to hold the system hostage as it's been. They want to continue the way things have been, which means if you don't vote, it's a no vote. Simple stuff. Before we go to break.
Yeah.
Let's do that. I got Tom on line one. You want to bring him up? Hey, Tom, how you doing tonight?
Good. I just want to let you know. You said that you paid like $15 and something for overnight something the other week.
It was not too long ago. It was actually mortgage documents.
Okay, well, I can tell you this much. I, a lot of times, wait till the last minute to pay my truck payment, so I usually end up overnighting it.
Okay.
And for the U.S. Post Office, for me to overnight that cost me almost $18.
Here again, you know, I don't know that to be the fact, but I'll take your word for it.
I know, because I pay it every time I do it.
Well, why do you do it?
because I wait till the last minute. I know it's my fault. You know, I know that, but I'm just saying, every time I end up waiting till the last minute to send my truck payment in, because they won't take the credit card over the phone, then I end up paying like $17.50, $17.70.
So let me ask you, because that's guaranteed overnight. So let me ask you this. Do you want to see the post office privatized?
To me, it doesn't matter, because most of my stuff I do online. To me, it doesn't really matter. I mean, I'm not one that's for a bigger government. I think if we can keep the government smaller, we're better off.
Even though it's constitutionally mandated that you have a post office?
Well, there's a lot of things that are probably constitutionally mandated that we don't follow. So
no, it's actually explicitly written right in the Constitution, Tom.
Yeah. Well, you know, it worked out for a while, but, you know, then I'm not sure what happened other than, you know, what you said about a lot of people not using it anymore, and the more people don't use it, either the price has got to go up or they got to do something with it, you know. It's all in what the, you know, how the new age and how everything moves nowadays compared to back, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
Point taken. Well, what happens to the rural areas that are no longer served because private for-profit companies won't do it?
Well, I don't know if they won't do it. I mean,
well, they won't do it for the same price that they'll do it in urban areas.
Well, it's all, you know, supply and demand is the only thing I can say. Yeah, I agree what you're, I see what you're saying, that by keeping it private or by keeping it through the public, that everybody pays the same across the board.
Yeah, see, here's the thing. When they mandated it constitutionally, they understood that we would all pay into it, we would all support it, and it would be a benefit for all of us equally across the board. That's what happens when you bring things into the public sphere and you have something called the commons, something that we all own together collectively. And that's why I'm in support of the post office.
Oh, and that's fine. That's your opinion. And like I said, as far as the post office part goes, I really don't have an opinion one way or the other on it. I just wanted to call in and let you know that, you know, for me to send something from here to, what's here? I think it's Nebraska is where it goes to.
Can I give you some advice?
What's that?
Send your car payment in on earlier next time.
Send it in earlier. Yes, I know.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Hey,
great talking to you.
You too.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Evan Ratner, Talk Radio Nurse News Service, back after this.
For the rest of us, Rick Smith.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happy!
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
That old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have a bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Where common sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., our friend Alan Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Alan, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you. We actually were attended two radio rows today, one on the Senate side, one on the House side, both aimed at getting, both run by Republicans and both aimed at underscoring the difference between the Republican agenda and the Democratic agenda.
And what did we find out?
Well, we didn't find out anything that new, except Rand Paul gave us sort of an interesting interview where he basically said, look, this gang of six or seven, depending on how you count it, is not telling the truth. And they're not saying that, yes, they say they're cutting $4 trillion in the budget, but the budget is, the debt is actually going to grow to almost $20 trillion over the next 10 years. So that's pretty much what he's saying, and he's saying, he doesn't like this gang of seven because he believes that they're not being truthful. Interesting perspective.
Yeah, interesting. You know, what was his plan? I mean, I look at this and I go, you know, who's the one going to suffer all this? I believe it's the people, you know, the way we're going, it's the people who can least afford it.
Right. Well, for sure, and actually some of the liberal groups are really going after them about going after that. And the Republicans on the House side were basically saying, look, you know, if the standard Republican line, we have to cut taxes, we have to cut taxes, we have to cut taxes. I finally asked one of them, I said, well, what about loopholes? Well, loopholes, you know, are okay or whatever, but I got one guy to admit that they really wanted to cut out, but he was from a non-Beltway state. He agreed they ought to cut out subsidies.
Well, I mean, duh, but here's my problem. I have yet to hear anyone talk about our trade deficit. Nobody is talking about the fact that we are buying trillions of dollars more from overseas than we're producing here. If we had those jobs, if we had sane trade policy, we wouldn't be worrying about the budget deficit. We would have income. Do you know when the last time we had a budget surplus in this country was?
I don't know the year.
1975.
Wow.
You know, what I've been saying is you cannot continue to have massive trade deficits like that since 1975. I mean, we're talking, what, 36 years?
That's a very long period of time.
So I hear nobody talking about that. All I hear about is we got to cut Granny's Social Security, we got to change Medicare to some bizarre voucher
plan. Trade policies are extremely unfair to the working person. And my view is if you increase the corporate taxes on these people, they say, well, it'll go down to the consumers. No, they need the American market. And even if they go offshore and you make the rules that they can't take, that they have to pay some taxes, they're not going to turn down the American market.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, I look at this report that this guy came out, and I don't know if you saw this or not, but he's the, you know, this big, huge lefty, this big, this rabid socialist. He's the chief investment officer at JP Morgan Chase, a big lefty. He said, quote, that the fact is of the matter is that profits are at the highest level they've seen since the mid-60s because labor costs are down, wages are down. He says the reduction in wages and benefits explain the majority of net improvement in margins, and in fact, wages and benefits are responsible for 75% of the major increases in corporate profits. The fact that they're stealing back those wages. Because they've got trade policies where they can move jobs overseas, and we actually give them more money for it.
For sure.
I'm sorry.
By the way, have you been following the Debbie Wasserman Schultz fight with Representative Alan West?
Is he just nuts or is it me?
Yeah, he is totally crazy. I mean, what she said, and I've been listening to the tape of it, and she said that she said it was unbelievable that a member from a senior heavy Southern Florida would support legislation. She never mentioned him by name. And then he makes a complaint about her, to the ethics committee and all that kind of stuff, and calls her the most vile, unprofessional, despicable member of the U.S. House of Representatives. Then rumor has it that he apologized to her, and then his people said that he didn't. It's just bizarre.
You know, again, you know, you hope next November, when it comes around for him to stand re-election, that the people of his district go, you know what, we tried, and you're just not the guy.
Wouldn't that be nice?
I mean, I got to be honest, he's entertaining at least.
He is very, he is absolutely entertaining. But I'll tell you, I mean, this guy in the U.S. Congress, and one of my hosts down there, Nicole Sandler, he tried to have her arrested, basically.
Yeah, I saw that.
Crazy.
Well, you know, welcome to Alan West's America. And when you look at him, he is the face of the extreme ideological right.
Yes. Very much. What can I say?
So,
and I would hope the people in Florida wake up.
Me too.
It was very interesting at the Republican House Radio Row. They really didn't have the off-the-wall wackos.
Oh, really?
Yes.
That surprises me. You would think you'd want the ones with the most venom and the most, the loudest voices out there, you know, tooting their position.
Interesting. Yes.
So are we going to see a budget deal soon? I mean, is this hostage situation going to end?
I have this from a very good source just about 10 minutes ago, that the House is not planning on working for the weekend, through the weekend, because they think they have a deal.
Well, then it will become how bad is this deal?
Right.
You know, you look at the fact that, you know, Boehner said the word compromise, he rejects it. I wonder how much of the word compromise is in this quote-unquote deal. And finally, hearings on the defense of marriage or respect for marriage thing. I've been watching some of the comments coming out. Another one of these situations where the crazies are out in full force.
Well, they are out in full force, and I don't think it's going to pass the House. But I do think that gives some impetus to the Supreme Court to realize that there are many Americans who believe that it's just unfair that a married couple gets all these tax and other advantages and that a gay couple doesn't. So it'll be interesting because nothing in that act says that a church or something has to do a gay marriage.
Yeah, see, because for me they're two very different worlds. There's the religious world and then there's the civil law. Because marriage really is two parts of it. You take your church thing, but then there's that legal contract that takes you almost forever to get out of. And I'm all in favor. We'll call it whatever you want, but I think people should have the same rights under the law.
I don't disagree with you at all. And I'll tell you what people aren't looking at it, and it's really interesting that they're all saying, look. It's going to be Romney, and Rick Perry can't raise the money, and if it's a credible Republican, Obama's not going to win because of these statistics. What they don't realize, though, is that they're coming out, anti-gay marriage, all that kind of stuff, and the people who were 10 to 14 years old, 12 years later, are now 22 to, 26 or so, and they're beginning to vote, and they think, the right is crazy on this kind of stuff.
Yeah, they do. But here's my problem. You know, you're going to get their base all fired up, and these issues do fire up their base. I don't know how Obama gets labor enthused about going out and fighting for him next November. I just don't know how that's going to happen. That's what scares me.
No, that the base. You hope the base does not stay home.
Yeah. Look what happened. Look what happened in 2010.
And although I got to tell you, looking at Romney as a candidate, they may go out.
Well, looking at Alan West, I'm hoping they go, oops, better not do this again.
Right. And they're also, the House is saying that they are thinking of, that what I'm hearing is they think they're going to even pick up a few more seats.
Well, we shall see. Alan Ratner, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Alan Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
Rock and roll.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer is a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Herman Cain train. Somebody must have grabbed him and said, hey, stop saying dumb stuff. You're ruining your shot. Because for a while there, he was a gaffe machine. Every time he turned around, he had something crazier to say, one right after the other. And here lately, I think a lot of the candidates have kind of pulled back, said, hold on, we better step out of the limelight right now. Because we don't want all the stink that the party's putting on us because of this hostage situation with the debt ceiling and the reauthorization of the FAA. But also, you know, they can't keep spending at the rate that they've been spending. And, you know, like I've been saying, I hope they blow through a whole bunch of campaign money. You know, let the investor class fund a little bit of the economy, since they seem to be hoarding all of the incentives that we've been giving them over the last couple of years. During the break, Ron sent me a link to a form of alternative housing that he says is starting to pick up momentum, and it's in shipping containers. And then the website was kind of interesting how they used shipping containers to make like a bi-level house. It's really interesting stuff. Caught my attention. And Jack also sent a link to the brochure for Tata Motors. And again, if you want to send me an email or a link to something, rick@thericksmithshow.com, I do appreciate it. But these ones that this Tata Homes has, the same people who made the Nano car, cute little houses. They look like those little pink sheds you see that are all dolled up to look like a cottage, only maybe a little bit bigger. But it kind of makes you think of how much do we actually need? That if someone can live in there, and I think back to my grandparents, they had three kids, like I have three kids. My house is twice as big as theirs was. And they figured out somehow to raise their children and exist and have privacy and be a family. You know, me, I can't find any place for my stuff. Yeah, it's amazing how things have changed. Also, William, during the first part of the show, sent me an email. Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Florida, he writes, are the states with the most toxic air pollution from coal and oil power plants. He says he got the information from a new report by an environmental advocacy group, the Natural Resource Defense Council. They use the EPA data and rank the top 20 worst states in the country. Ohio is number one. Congratulations to them. But then Pennsylvania's right there, followed by Florida, Kentucky, Maryland, Indiana, Michigan, and then down on to the bottom where Iowa was number 20th. And he says, you know, overall, U.S. power plants emitted 771 million pounds of toxic chemicals in 2009 with the electric sector. Now, the people who generate your power are responsible for 49% of all industrial toxic air pollution, or about 382 million pounds of this toxic stuff. And again, you know, there's got to be a better way of doing this. There's got to be a better way of producing energy. Look, after all, you know, Ohio and Pennsylvania are the two hot spots in this country for mercury pollution. We've got mercury in, they were telling pregnant women, don't eat the fish. It's going to kill you. Or it's going to harm your baby because, you know, mercury, not a good thing. So you're seeing EPA trying to, you know, revise a little bit of the public health protections. And to me, it comes down to some common sense. Why aren't we generating more electricity through solar, through wind? Why aren't we doing other things? Why aren't we investing in, going and insulating granny's house so we don't use as much energy? Why aren't we retrofitting buildings to be energy independent? Why aren't we doing a lot of the smart things to get people back to work? You know, our debt problems are because people aren't working and we're spending a lot of money on saving the economy from collapsing. And saving all of those social problems that we've been talking about. Anyway, another email I got. Tosh writes, Rick, on 9/11, the TSA function was private. It was federalized because the FAA and lawmakers and the Bush administration concluded that screeners beholden to the airlines were not adequate. And, you know, the reality is they want to take us back to the privatized system that got us into the mess on 9/11. And you hear this often from the right. It's better if it's in the hands of a private for-profit corporation. And it goes two ways here. One way they become like they were, customer friendly. Whatever you want, sir. Sure, take on that 9-foot machete. Sure, you want to roll a cannon in behind you? No problem. You can go that direction, or you go the other way, where the porno scanners are the least of your worries. And you have no say over what happens because it's private. You know, understand the reason all this complaining is going on now with the TSA people is because they work for the government. You can complain about them, but a for-profit private industry, you've got no rights there. It's not your right. They'll just ship you out the door. You don't fly. Which leads me to the story about the woman who evidently is now going to be a right-wing hero. I think she's a Japanese woman, Yukira Miyami. She was originally arrested on a felony count of sexual abuse. Evidently, she allegedly, before the TSA agent patted her down, she allegedly reached over and squeezed the woman's chest, giving her a little twister there on both sides. And you go, wow, what were you thinking? But now this Colorado woman, she's going to be a hero regardless. They've said that they're not going to pursue felony charges against her. And personally, there's part of me that goes, you got to do something with her because now is this going to become an epidemic? Is it going to be a situation where every time something you get in a situation like this, somebody's going to be striking back? Not sure. The other story that came out with the TSA, they're evidently getting rid of the porno scanners. There'll be no more images, so you're not going to see the, and I don't know how many people, have you gotten this calendar that they sent out via email with the, you know, it's like a centerfold calendar, only it's the, you know, the x-rays, which I thought was hysterical. But, you know, they're saying now it's not going to be anatomical. They're just going to, the software that they have now is just going to be a generic body outline. There'll be no, no definition. So if they do detect something, then they'll actually, you know, do an actual image of the passenger. So here again, there's part of me that goes, you know, I'm not a big fan of the whole porno scanner. I'm really not a fan of the pat downs. I'm not a fan of the strip search. I'm a fan of flying naked. You know, you just put the piece of paper on the seat and everyone flies naked. You don't have a problem. Unless, you know, like they were saying, you know, the terrorists are planning on planting bombs inside of people. And I go, you know, at what point do we just go, you know what? Stuff happens. We're never going to see another 9/11. You're never going to see another passive set of passengers. Someone stands up with a box cutter and says, I'm taking over this plane. You're going to have 100 people beating the tar out of them. So, you know, again, this whole thing, to me, should be ended. We should be ending this whole process. We should be searching people's baggage, searching with the things that they take on, and limiting the amount of stuff that they're allowed to take on. And look, if you see somebody, you know, with a shirt that's bulging with stuff, yeah, you go check them out. But for the most part, this is ridiculous. You know, taking off your shoes. And I think of my friend Ari, who, you know, God rest his soul, was a guy who, once he took off his boots during the day, there was no getting them back on. Because his feet just exploded because he had circulation problems and the water would just load up in his feet. And they still made this poor guy take his shoes off. And I see these elderly folks who are struggling to take their shoes on and off. You know, it's a shame. But here's the thing. If you start making exceptions for the elderly and for children, but you're gonna strip search everybody else, where do you think the terrorists decide to put their bombs? But again, I don't ever see that happening again. Interesting story out of Japan. You know, again, you know, when crisis happens, you get innovation. They've got some power problems. They now have jackets that are air conditioned. They come with built-in fans. So, you know, I can't pronounce the name of the company, but it literally in Japanese means air conditioned clothes. It has a little power supply. It has little fans that go on. Kind of, you know, blows you up like the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. And it keeps you cold inside, or cool inside. And you're seeing a lot of people who work in factories, a lot of people who work construction, and basically people who don't care about fashion at all but just want to be cool, saying, you know what, I'm going to be walking around in my giant Stay Puft Marshmallow suit just to say more cool, because they're having some serious energy shortages there because of the March 11th earthquake and the tsunami that hit. So, you know, again, you know, how do I get a air-conditioned jacket? I mean, last night I went home and it was just brutal. And, of course, my wife decided this would be a great night to let's not use the air conditioning because we want to save electricity and, you know, all the energy that we created the day with our solar panels, we wanted to save. And I said, no. We put the solar panels on the roof to cut down on how much energy we use from the grid. We put the solar panels on the house to save some money. We put the solar panels on the house to save some CO2 going into the environment. We did not put the solar panels on the house for us to sweat to death. And where are the people denying global warming today? Where are my deniers? Because it has been stinking hot the last couple of days. And I think of, you know, the Drew Carey thing. I wonder if he thinks it's so funny now, spraying the aerosol can into the air, going, screw the grandkids, I'm cold now. It is definitely not cold. And I hope she turned the air conditioning on before I get home, because it is another brutal evening. So here, the last story I've got, you go through and you look at, what do you think a fun outdoor activity is? I look at the one in Nebraska. A good story from Omaha, and you go, what could be the worst thing that you could do on a 95-degree day with high humidity, the sun beating down? What would be the worst thing? Well, evidently, today, they hosted the 2011 North American Manure Expo. That's right, huge piles of manure. Now, think about this. They actually have a trade show for manure. It is billed as the only training event in the world that spreads animal waste to demonstrate the latest advances in manure management technology. They say managing manure is a big issue on farms. A 300-cow dairy operation produces, on average, 8,725 gallons of waste per day and more than 3.1 million gallons per year. That's according to research from Clemson University. So this big expo is going to teach folks on how to deal with their manure. And I'm going, whose bright idea was it to do it in July? I mean, even if it's a cool, mild July, it's still in the high 80s. Why would you choose July? You know, why not January? Piles of manure don't smell that bad in January. But here on a 95-degree day, high humidity, it is the grand 2011 North American Manure Expo. Get your tickets now. I wonder if they're giving tickets away. I wonder if you could give tickets away to that. oh, boy. Anyway, I want to thank our guests today. Look, folks, this hostage situation that's going on, this debt ceiling problem we've got, to me, it's not about the BS that they're throwing at us. It's about our trade deficit. And I really wish people would catch on to this. Call their representatives. Tell their representatives, look, if we had that $10 trillion in goods that we bought from overseas, if we had that back, you know, since 1976, had we had sane trade policies that balanced our trade deficit, we wouldn't be in the mess we're in now. And, you know, as I've been saying, the last year this country had a trade surplus was 1975. You're looking at some 36 years ago. And over that time, we have purchased nearly $10 trillion worth of goods from overseas. If we manufactured that stuff here at home, would we be in the debt problems we're in? Those workers who had good-paying union jobs, who could pay into their communities? I argue no. And that's why I encourage everyone to call your representative, tell them we need sane trade policies. We'll be back tomorrow night. Have a great night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the sway, imperial, mysterious, and amorous gray. Democracy is coming to the USA.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
I teach at the middle school. I fight it hard to catch my breath. The kids are scattered. Parents frantic. They're all worried about the tests. But is it my fault that the scores aren't higher? The kids are so misbehaved. They took my aid. My class keeps growing and the board won't split back my pain. When did I become a problem? How did all come on mine? School board says, tighten the belt.